next speaker is Len Wineglass.
I wanted to pick up and add to the remarks of Clark Kissinger. It's true that the beginning of the end of civil liberties as we know them did not just happen overnight on September 11th. Actually, the USA Patriot Law, which Clark referred to, is a bill that's 342 pages long. It was introduced within 3 weeks of September 11th. It is a compilation of all those provisions which previous Congresses have rejected as being denials of our fundamental rights. Overnight, it became the law of the land. No hearings, no reports from the committee, no conference committee, virtually no debate, and overnight, there was a sea change in our civil liberties landscape. But to understand really on the ground level what this means to us, you have to go back to 1972, 30 years ago. The Nixon administration tried to get from the United States Supreme Court the approval to wiretap Americans without the need to get a warrant from a district court upon proof of probable cause. They claimed it under national security. In 1972, the Supreme Court rejected that argument unanimously and said that if the government is going to wiretap U.S. citizens, it must get a warrant from a federal court. Within that decision was one sentence which pretty much has led to the beginning of the end of Fourth Amendment protections, as well as First Amendment, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment. That sentence said, although we don't give the president the right to wiretap on domestic security, nothing in this opinion shall apply to the power of the president to conduct foreign intelligence operations. So the Congress of the United States, 6 years later, in 1978, seized on that one sentence and set up a separate, what Clark referred to as a secret court system operating outside the Constitution of the United States, called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. This is a court that has received very little attention. And it's a court like no other. It doesn't have a courthouse. It meets in an office on the sixth floor of the Justice Department. That office is a windowless office, which is locked and has a guard in the front. And it conducts all of its proceedings in secret. It issues no opinions and no decisions. And it is made up of just seven judges. And those judges become judges when they're handpicked by the Chief Justice of the United States to sit on that secret court. It is a governmental structure that Lavrenti Beria would have been very proud of. It just issues warrants, warrants authorizing electronic surveillance. And in its 21 years, how many warrants has it issued? It has issued 11,950 warrants up until 2 years ago. And all of those warrants are secret. Lawyers are not allowed to look at the papers that are the applications for the warrants. They're secret also. They can't even contest and challenge it because the whole proceeding is secret. And so you have this parallel court system to our regular court system. And in the last few years, this secret court has issued more warrants for electronic surveillance than all the federal courts in the United States combined. When the law was passed, and incidentally, it was passed with the approval of the ACLU and with Senator Edward Kennedy being one of the sponsors, Kennedy said this law, which Clark said was going to only deal with foreign diplomats, he said, well, I can't imagine there being more than 100 warrants a year out of this court. The last few years, there have been 600 a year. And, of course, Congress said, we're setting up the separate court system, but we're going to endow it with a lot of, quote, safeguards, protections. It's only going to be for foreign intelligence. Well, that very quickly got watered down. CISPES became a target of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. That's foreign intelligence. And then they said, none of this information can be used in a criminal trial, so we're not talking about abrogating rights. There have been 90 trials leading to convictions where foreign intelligence information gathered through this secret court was used in a criminal case, 90 cases. And none of those cases could the lawyers look at the papers. And why couldn't they look at the papers? Under the law, the Attorney General certifies the papers are too sensitive to be shown to a lawyer. And how can you gather foreign intelligence information and use it in a criminal case? The Attorney General certifies, I'm going to allow this information to be used now in a criminal case. So it's used. And so the safeguards that were built in were safeguards that really, in the course of a very short period of time, became non-existent. And now, the foreign intelligence courts are the weapon of choice of prosecutors. They go there more often than they go to regular federal courts, where you have to file in writing your reasons for doing electronic surveillance, and the attorneys get an opportunity to look at your reasons and challenge them. That doesn't happen now. The courts have existed in a way that enables a complete circumvention of what are traditional protections. Let me give you a brief example. I'm now involved in a case called the Squillicott Stand case. I don't know how many of you are familiar with it. Terry Squillicott and Kurt Stand were a young couple in Washington. The government suspected wrongfully that they were providing classified information to the GDR, the government of East Germany. And so what did the government do? They didn't have a basis for arguing that, so they went into a FISA court, a secret court, and they got permission to tape record every conversation in and out of that house for 550 days, a year and a half. 5,000 conversations were taped. The law only allows taping for 90 days. But what did the government do? They applied for an extension 21 times. Each time they were granted an extension. 550 days of surveillance of the telephone, plus the law by amendment under Clinton, 1995, now allows not just wiretapping, but it authorizes break-ins. And so they broke into the Squillicott Stand house, a modest house, and they put microphones in virtually every room, the kitchen, the living room, the marital bedroom. And for 550 days, they tape recorded every conversation taking place in that small house. At the end of that period of time, they didn't have enough evidence to prosecute. So what did they do? They brought in a team of psychologists, and they sat them down for about a week in Washington, and they played the tapes for these psychologists. And the psychologist drew up what's called a behavioral assessment profile. in which they looked at the family based on all these tapes, and they figured out where the weak link was in that family, how they could penetrate the family. And what they found was that the wife was suffering from a depression, that her sister had committed suicide, and that she had personal problems of late that caused her to feel very vulnerable, very isolated, and most importantly, very alone. So they brought in an FBI agent, and the psychologist trained the agent on how to penetrate the family, particularly focusing on the wife, and dwelling on her weaknesses over a period of time. They got the wife to provide the agent with material that the government then used to prosecute them, going back over 20 years. And the wife is now serving 21 and a half years, and Kurt Stan, the husband, is serving 17 and a half years. So this is, if you have any question, if you think, well, giving the government the power to intrude electronically, to enter our homes by break-in, does not necessarily lead to further violations of our rights of privacy and our civil liberties, you just have to look at the Squillicott-Stan case and see the number of manipulative instruments that are available to the government to penetrate a private family and to bring that family to court and ultimately to prison. So we're not dealing with hypotheticals. We're not dealing with imaginary things. Attorney General Ashcroft referred to us as those who engage in phantoms of lost civil liberties. Well, this court is not a phantom. It's real and it exists. And the kinds of cases represented by Squillicott and Stan are not phantoms. We are dealing with real, serious problems. And if John Ashcroft is to be remembered for one thing, it won't be the statue, although that's not a bad beginning point. It will be that he's changed the mission of the Justice Department, a department that used to be, for better or worse, committed to the prosecution of crimes that had been committed, allegedly. That is no longer the primary mission of the Justice Department. The primary mission, in his words, is to deter crime, which means before a crime is committed, the resources of the Justice Department are to be committed to finding out those who might be most likely to commit the crime before they do it. And if no one else, that kind of thinking targets, and the new law is fairly vague, but I think specific on this, those who oppose the policies of the government are those who are, quote, most likely to commit the crimes according to the government. The government is very zealous when it's the government itself that's a victim, not too zealous in many other instances, but that means it's directed and targeted at the political community, the immigrant community, the community that the powers in Washington believes are the most likely to commit the crimes. So I'll close with that. I think it's very important. I called up FISA on the internet under Google, and there were over 21 pages of references to FISA. But understandably, not a lot is known because it's not a subject that's ordinarily covered by the mainstream press. But it's something that we really ought to know about because the history of it and the way we lost our civil liberties and the threats that are now posed by that loss are very real. Thank you.